Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If not the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general. King Khalid Muhammad, we gon' make your day a holiday. I fuck me, promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, kid, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
We're live today with Dr. Peter McCullough, who's joining us. He's become a bit of a regular here at Z Media. We thank him so much for all of his effort going global, letting people know what the dangers of these so-called vaccines are, and really helping people stay informed as to the real science around these injections. Dr. McCullough, thank you so much for your time and joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Dr. McCullough, we've seen some really alarming statistics coming out of the United States. We're relying heavily on the United States. I said to you last time, you guys are leading the way as usual. Female infertility, 472% increase. Pulmonary embolism, 468% increase. I'm reading from the recent findings from Senator Ron Johnson's conference. Ovarian dysfunction, 437%. Testicular cancer, 369%. These are absolutely astronomical and alarming numbers, Dr. McCullough.
They certainly are. And we heard at the January 24th Second Opinion Senate testimony, it was 5 hours of testimony in Washington. It was in the Kennedy Caucus Room in the U.S. Senate building, led by Republican Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. I was honored to co-moderate the program. We had over a dozen leading clinical scientists who treat COVID-19. We had vaccine developers, both messenger RNA and adenoviral DNA developers there. We had nurses, patients, and attorneys. And towards the final segment of the testimony, the DMED database was presented by Tom Rentz, and that's the data you just cited. Now, DMED is a clinical occurrence system. It's not VAERS. It's the Department of Defense Epidemiologic Database. So we know when someone has developed an illness in the military, the 2.7 million Americans enrolled in the military. And this corroborates and is consistent with the CDC VAERS system, which is spontaneous reporting, the yellow card system, which is spontaneous reporting in the UK, and then the UDRA system and VigiSafe system in Europe. So these are all complementary, and they point to what we're seeing now, which is almost a genetic catastrophe. When we load genetic material on lipid nanoparticles and then literally let them go anywhere in the body they want to go, which happens after injection. And they go into the brain, the reproductive organs, the adrenal glands, the heart, bone marrow. We really have set up the human body for biologic catastrophe. We were stunned with a paper that came in from Holkin and colleagues demonstrating that the messenger RNA is found in human lymph nodes 2 months after the injection. So when someone takes the first shot of a messenger RNA vaccine, and then they take another shot a month later, the very first shot is still not out of the body before they're loaded with more genetic material.
And there was another very, very disturbing finding recently by Lund University, which is showing that the study is claiming that this may give rise to the concern if a vaccine-derived DNA may be integrated into the host genome and affect the integrity of genomic DNA, which may potentially mediate genotoxic side effects. Can you talk us through what this study has revealed, Dr. McCullough?
So this is cohesive with the finding by Holkin and colleagues that, you know, if the messenger RNA stays in the body too long, it's possible that, in fact, considerable amounts of it could actually have the base pairs of DNA begin to line up against the messenger RNA and make the reverse code. It's called reverse transcriptase. And what was discovered by Marcus Alden and colleagues in the University of Lund in Malmo, Sweden, was in fact in hepatic cell lines, when and the right cell line had to be chosen, that the liver, the hepatocytes, are the sites that actually produce the most protein. They're set up to do this. In fact, a hepatic cell line with Pfizer vaccine did in fact reverse transcribe. Now the reverse transcriptase is known as called line one. And so the DNA code for at least part of the spike protein was found inside the human nucleus as quickly as 6 hours after injection. That was very quick. And it's right in the middle. It's called the amplicon, 444 base pairs out of the 3,800 base pairs. We've looked at this pretty carefully in scientific circles, and the belief is because it's the middle segment that was transcribed, almost certainly the entire DNA code for the spike protein is in fact transferred into the human nucleus. Now the clinical questions are that, you know, provided validation is there, how much of this is permanently installed into the human DNA? And then is it passed from parent cells to daughter cells, not only in, you know, organs like the liver, but also in gametocytes, which means, you know, is it passed down once it's in the testicles and the ovaries? Is it a permanent install and then installing into future, you know, unborn children? This is a very disturbing finding. Our CDC has said, given assurances, that there's no way that these genetic vaccines change the human genome. And now we know in the last few weeks that that's not a true statement. Dr. Anthony Karagoglis and myself had previously published that we thought this was going to happen based on the configuration of messenger RNA. In fact, we were right. Now there'll be a variety of confirmatory studies. You know, we're hopeful that there's gene editing and gene splicing and other corrective, you know, natural processes that can get rid of this messenger RNA. not cause too much damage to the human genome, and get the spike protein out of the body, the spike protein that's produced by the messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA, we believe now stays in the body for over a year. So if you take shot one and shot two, you have over a year to get this stuff out of your body. And no wonder people feel bad, have blood clots, muscle aches, neurologic problems, all kinds of problems after the vaccines. But the general advice is now that we know the vaccines don't work, is don't take any more of these shots, because it's just going to accumulate an increasing and compounding health hazard.
What are some other repercussions of DNA, of this interference with human DNA, do we know yet?
It depends on where the insertion occurs in the chromosomes. Now, in the Alden paper, we know it's in chromatin, so it's in human chromosomes. The question is where. If it's into the HERV region, and we believe this happens with SARS-CoV-2 viral infections, that there's some reverse transcription, the consequences can be, in a sense, crowding an area where there's foreign genetic material, and that crowding effect basically causes reactivation syndromes. So reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus, which does do a permanent installation, or reactivation of the herpes zoster virus causing shingles. That's pretty well described after COVID-19 infection. So if it's in that region, we'd worry about reactivation syndromes. If it's in other regions, one of the disturbing findings in a paper by Singh and colleagues from the University of Pittsburgh last year, it was shown that the S2 segment of the spike protein, which is present in the human body after vaccination, that it unfavorably interacts with the P53 and the BRCA genes. These are cancer genes, P53 governing solid organ tumors, melanoma, kidney cancer, et cetera, and then BRCA governing breast cancer and female reproductive cancers. So we had the biological link that just by producing the spike protein, we could accentuate cancer risk. And now the Department of Defense data that you pointed out, just presented on January 24th, is the first data set suggesting year-on-year increases in cancer. This is very disturbing. People take the vaccines. Most of them didn't know what they were signing up for. They can't get it out of the human body. And now we may have an oncogenic protein basically permanently installed in the human body.
This is so disturbing, Dr. McCullough, and it's disappointing because people like you have been warning people for so long, and of course people felt pressured and felt like they couldn't work unless they got these injections, but I think a lot of people that held out are finding comfort in the fact that they've avoided some of these potential health problems. There was a statement recently made by Dr. My apologies, I've lost the article, saying that, here we go, Dr. Erso, the triple vaccinated are most likely to die. Do you know what this statement is about, Dr. McCullough? Have we got evidence? I mean, there is evidence to suggest that the immune system is weakening more and more the more of these shots that you get. Is that an accurate statement?
We're starting to see signs of that. And I'll bring up the citation. You know, one of the things when, you go on an interview with me is I don't give any opinions. And the fact checkers have never been able to say that there's misinformation given, because I simply quote the data. We have multiple data sources suggesting that the vaccines are backfiring. And some of the best data sets are coming out of the UK and Scotland, the Scottish COVID-19 public health statistics. And they are showing now for fully vaccinated, double vaccinated, triple vaccinated, increasing numbers of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And it really markedly outnumbers the risk in those who are unvaccinated. The World Health Organization had come out with the European Medical Agency and put out an advice against boosters. And one of the pieces of rationale that they used against boosters was that it could potentially weaken the immune system. And the mechanisms were that the messenger RNA is staying in the lymph nodes for a long period of time, so the body's preoccupied with trying to get rid of it, as well as the deposition of spike protein, which is a huge burden on the body as the body begins to clear the spike protein. And then to actually pour on more messenger RNA, which forces more spike protein. And then, in fact, when the infection happens, since the spike protein has not been modified to actually match the current variants, that now the current variants are even potentially more virulent in individuals. This isn't necessarily an antibody-dependent enhancement, but it's almost like an immune system overload or a breakdown or, in a sense, an attenuation of what should be a robust immune system to SARS-CoV-2. So now we're finding people who have taken these vaccines, when sadly, when they get COVID-19, they're far more likely to be hospitalized or, in fact, die. Now, a recent paper from France that has just come out in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and I'll bring up the citation for you that it was on my Twitter feed. Anybody wants to go to my Twitter feed, you'll see this. The first author is Bouzid and colleagues, B-O-U-Z-I-D and colleagues, titled the paper's Comparison of Patients Infected with Delta versus Omicron in the COVID-19 Variants Presenting to Paris Emergency Departments. And of those with Omicron now sick enough to go to the emergency room, 65% were vaccinated, 65%, most of them double or triple jabbed. So it's clear the vaccines are clearly not working. They're not working in Scotland. They're not working in Paris. Even our data in the United States, which has been biased on hospitalizations, is not showing any advantage to taking a vaccine at this point in time.
Dr. McCullough, how can the CDC get away with having told us what appears to be lies this entire time? They told us that it wouldn't affect our DNA. They told us that they would be safe and effective. What, I mean, do any repercussions exist for these people?
They should if they don't change their guidance. You know, you could say out of the gate that the randomized trials showed that the vaccines didn't have major safety signals and they were about 90% effective. That's what the registrational trials showed. But as we started to see the rollout, it was clear they weren't safe. And we know that now from the first tranche of Pfizer documents released from the lawsuit that was led by lead attorney Aaron Seary, co-counsel Elizabeth Brem. They sued the FDA and Pfizer, said, release your data. You have 400,000 pages of data. The FDA apparently has already seen all this. Why can't Americans see what Pfizer sees? We've been asked to take these vaccines, in fact, forced to face the vaccines, show us the data. We knew there was a problem because the judge, the lawyer for the FDA convinced the judge not to release it for 55 years. We said that's too late. Then they doubled down. They wanted over 70 years. Finally, Siri prevailed, and it's going to be over 9 months. We got the first bundle, and we were stunned to find out that within 90 days worldwide, Pfizer knew about 1,223 deaths that occurred shortly after the Pfizer vaccine. And Pfizer didn't say a word. The CDC, US FDA didn't say a word. Albert Bourla was on national TV today, and I provided commentary on US TV on a different station, advising Americans to take a fourth vaccine, and the interviewer didn't ask him about the 1,223 deaths. That's what people want to know about. What are they dying of when they take the Pfizer vaccine? They don't want to hear about a fourth shot. They want to know, why are people dying after the vaccine? And, you know, the interviewer didn't ask Bourla, and he certainly didn't bring it up. And so, you know, there's an oblivion right now to safety. The interviewers, the media is oblivious. The CEO of these companies are obviously, you know, financially conflicted, but they're oblivious to safety. And, you know, the whole world is pushing back. You know, worldwide in the United States included, about two-thirds of the world took a vaccine. Two-thirds of Americans take the vaccine. And we got a third of Americans that just don't want it. They've seen too much. They're not convinced they're safe. They're clearly not convinced they're effective. Many of those who didn't take the vaccine, they already had COVID. They already had COVID once or twice. If they figure, why take the vaccine? It's too late for the vaccine. They've already had COVID. And so we have, of the two-thirds who took the vaccine in the United States, it's my estimate that a third have remorse, that they took it. They took it early. They've seen a lot of safety data that's not comforting. And many people tell me, Dr. McCullough, I'm not taking a booster. I took it early. But there's no booster for me. And then we have about a third, it's my estimate about a third, that I really, really believe in these vaccines. They want to take more shots and take more boosters. And you know, the general feeling is where there's risk, there must be choice. And if people want to continue taking these boosters at their own choice, that is their choice. But those who don't want it, they've seen enough, they've already had shots, they're effectively unvaccinated. By the way, anybody who has not taken a shot in the United States after October 1st is effectively unvaccinated. My back of the envelope estimation is 250 million out of 330 million Americans are effectively unvaccinated at this point in time. And the rates of vaccination, as been reported in the major media, are at their lowest. The interest in taking a vaccine in the United States is very low.
Good. So it should be. Meanwhile, you've got the World Health Organization saying that now boosters should proceed with boosters. You mentioned Albert Bella. We've actually got one of Australia's top doctors, Dr. Nick Coatsworth, who's made a statement saying that Pfizer would do the world a favor if they stopped talking about fourth COVID doses. It's not their role. It probably borders on irresponsible to be talking about fourth doses when there's a significant number of people around the world who haven't had the opportunity to get vaccinated. He goes on to say it's also purely designed to generate revenue from wealthy countries worried about fourth doses. But the problem that we have is that he says that what they should be focusing on is providing these vaccines to all low-income nations. And no, we shouldn't. They're not safe. They're not effective. The focus shouldn't be on providing more of these. I mean, I'm grateful that he's criticizing the fourth dose advice.
Yeah, but they're criticizing it for the wrong reasons. I just pulled up the WHO statement. Now, this came out December 22nd and comes from United Nations communication. It says, World Health Organization warns against blanket boosters as vaccine inequity persists. And so they're making the case, the reason why people shouldn't take boosters is because, you know, the distribution is not equitable even for the first shots. But the real reason not to take a booster is the vaccines don't work, and we have mounting evidence that they're ineffective. I don't think it's an equity issue. I think people who have not taken a shot right now are pretty happy they didn't. I tell you, everybody in my circles who've passed on the vaccines, they as they see the blood clots, the myocarditis, the deaths start to occur, they are thrilled they didn't take the vaccine. I mean, it is extraordinary. We just saw a very famous young female golfer in the United States develop a blood clot in her arm. And we just never see that. There's a condition called thoracic outlet obstruction that can actually, have a predilection in golfers. That can happen in baseball players. But it's the thrombogenic nature of the vaccine. And in all these cases, the mysterious piece of information is, did they take the vaccine or not? We just heard about Justin Bieber, his wife, having a blood clot in her brain. When do we hear that in young people like that? Again, the mystery piece of information is, did they take the vaccine? No one's being clear on this. All these athletes who've died on the field in Europe, the soccer players, rugby players, again, did they take the vaccine? Now, sooner or later, people are going to have to come clean on this because many, many people think that, in fact, they did. And anytime people are silent on this exposure, the assumption now is they took the vaccine and they simply just don't want to disclose that.
We've had three prominent figures in Australia in the past week pass away with heart problems, Dr. McCullough, and they're denying the links to the vaccines. In a recent article, you've written a recent article saying why, the Citizen Free Press has written a recent article about your statements, why athletes are dying. And we're seeing, again, our mainstream media are saying most older men would ignore chest pain while exercising, a study finds. It's like this mainstream conditioning of people to just think that heart attacks are normal, completely denying the links to these vaccines. But why are athletes dying? You spoke about a surge in adrenaline and the underlying vaccine-induced myocarditis. Could you talk us through that?
You know, this theory is really starting to take hold that, you know, the US FDA and the regulatory agencies agree that the messenger RNA vaccines cause myocarditis. There's no dispute about this. So when the agencies warn that the products cause myocarditis, you know, young people and parents ought to listen to that. If something causes heart damage, the natural parental reflex would be don't inject that into your children. I mean, that should be pretty straightforward for parents to understand. I mean, the agencies are telling you, don't do this. But having said that, Still, many parents walk their kids into vaccinations, or the kids feel pressured or forced into doing it. And what we've learned is the highest risk group is age 18 to 24. In men, 90% of these cases are young men, as shown by Scharf and colleagues in the preprint server system. And then a report by Gill and colleagues from Connecticut, Connecticut coroners, backed up by analyses from the University of Michigan and the University of Wisconsin Pathology, published in one of the best pathology journals, Archives of Pathology. Two young boys, 16 and 17, they take Pfizer and they die on days 3 and 4 after the Pfizer shot. They're found dead at home. And the parents are horrified and they call for an autopsy. And the autopsy show, indeed, the kids died of vaccine-induced myocarditis. But the interesting finding is the histopathology looked like there was an overlay of what's called catecholamine toxicity. There must have been a surge of adrenaline. Now, this may have been from antecedent athletic activity. We don't know. Or it could just be in the throes of dying, the struggle of these boys. They died at home. Their parents weren't there, struggling for the last breaths of life before they died of the vaccine. That could have been the surge of catecholamines. But lead investigator, Dr. Flavio Cattagiani from Brasilia, I just interviewed him on the McCullough Report. He believes it's perfectly consistent with the hypothesis that the vaccine sets up the heart inflammation, which can be very subtle. In fact, some of it can have no symptoms whatsoever. And then it's the big surge of adrenaline during a soccer game or during a basketball game, during sports, that's triggering these deaths. And boy, that theory fits. And he has a paper out in the preprint server system outlining how that really happens. And now, today, it's on my Twitter feed. There's a school, school physician office that said that no child will play until they have blood tests to see if they have heart inflammation. So now the vaccine is creating extra medical procedures, even for clearance before athletics. And now three countries, certainly in Canada, Hospital for Sick Children, the UK, as well as Australia, the governmental authorities have issued guidelines for doctors, largely cardiologists like myself, to follow for screening, detection, and management of vaccine-induced myocarditis. It's as if this heart damage occurring with the vaccines is now becoming a normal part of medical life for cardiologists.
Not normal. This is not normal, and the effort of the mainstream and governments to normalize this, there isn't even a peep to say, hey, this is a real problem and now we're having to do this. No, it's just we're showing you this as if this is normal life, and it's not. The other problem that we've got, so I'm looking here, reported cases of multi-system inflammatory syndrome. This is one of your posts. In children aged 12 to 20 years who received a COVID-19 vaccine from December 2020 through to August 2021. So there's these numbers again. What is a multi-system inflammatory syndrome? Why is it targeting this age group in particular, and why are these numbers so high?
This is another example of, you know, what I think is going on here is I think that in young people, the cells are younger and they more avidly take up the genetic material. It makes a lot of sense. And when a lot of genetic material is taken up in a young person who takes the vaccine, this paper that you quote by Anna Youssef and colleagues was published in Lancet Child and Adolescent Health. The title of the paper is Reported Cases of Multisystem Inflammatory Syndrome, Children Aged to 20 in the United States Who Received the COVID Vaccine. And this is stunning. These children who get it get incredibly sick. It looks like about a large fraction of them had evidence of COVID-19 before they took the shot, so they didn't need it. So in a sense, the body was primed. But it's stunning that about 40% needed medications to keep their blood pressure up. About 60% were admitted to the ICU. And sadly, 13% were placed on the mechanical ventilator. So can you imagine giving your child a vaccine that you think you're doing the right thing and the child develops this horrific syndrome? This is way worse than developing COVID-19 itself. People have argued that, oh, I'm going to give COVID the vaccine to my child so they don't develop severe COVID-19. In fact, this multi-inflammatory system that develops is far worse than COVID-19, the respiratory illness. And like so many papers, the authors try to minimize and say it's rare. And what I've said in my U.S. Senate testimony, I said, listen, one case is too many. One, because the children are largely unaffected by COVID-19. Even if they get COVID-19, it's very easily treatable with some nebulizers and other drugs. Even our monoclonal antibodies, our highest tech drugs in COVID, can be used down to age 12. If we had a child with cystic fibrosis or advanced Down syndrome, I just met with one of the candidates running for county judge here in Dallas, and she gave me a vignette of a 20-year-old young man with Down syndrome. He develops COVID-19. He gets denied all early treatment, and that poor soul was admitted to the hospital, and he was given remdesivir. And remdesivir is known to be associated with more deaths than not giving remdesivir. He was treated far too late. Then he was treated with a toxic drug. The World Health Organization says don't use remdesivir. But yet in U.S. hospitals, it's done. And sadly, this young man lost his life. So we know COVID-19 is grossly mismanaged, can result in death in these horrific cases. And taking the vaccine offers this risk of multi-system inflammatory disorder, putting the kids on the ventilator. This is a horror show for parents. Parents need to keep their kids healthy and safe away from these vaccines.
A lot of people have a question about vaccine-associated enhanced disease or vaccine-induced autoimmune disease. Dr. McCullough, do we have any evidence around that?
You know, in my view, we still haven't met, you know, some clear-cut thresholds for antibody-dependent enhancement. We are starting to see more severe disease in those who are vaccinated, clearly in adults. I gave you the Scottish data, but it's the same for Denmark, the UK, and Israel right now. The United States doesn't have fair hospitalization data, so we can't look to the United States. But it's clear the vaccines are backfiring. Three analyses by Subramanian, Camp, and Beatty show worldwide, the more we vaccinate, the more COVID we have. The worse it becomes. We're making the problem worse and worse. It shouldn't even lasted 2 years if we didn't have the vaccine program and we just took care of, we treated the sick patients who got it early, this probably would have been over with now. Now we hear stories that there's waves of new pockets of new disease in susceptible populations, including China and East Asia. So again, these are gonna ultimately threaten down towards Australia and New Zealand. So, you know, this keeps going and going. There needs to be an immediate halt to the U.S. vaccine program. We need a redirection towards early treatment. And we need to bolster natural immunity. More people get through it. I gave a national program last week in Nashville, Tennessee. We had thousands of people there. I asked for a show of hands how many had already had COVID. 90% of people raised their hands. So United States, I think we're done. Most of us have been through it once or twice now. And if there is a possible third infection, it's going to be indistinguishable from the common cold.
I've said that there's a new variant that is, well, that there's a couple. We've got BA.2, Omicron BA.2, and we've also got Deltacron. And they're saying that these could be more virulent, more transmissible, more harmful. How does that happen with a virus? Aren't viruses supposed to get weaker as time goes on?
Well, the Omicron variant is the most highly mutated of all the strains, and it has a lot of mutations in the spike protein. But interestingly, it had enough of the mutation in the spike protein to where the S gene primer of the PCR literally dropped out. And you still could diagnose it based on the N and the E and the other primers, but the S gene dropped out. It showed you how dysmorphic the S protein was. Now, that's the BA1 subvariant of Omicron. But the BA2 variant, in a sense, that S gene is restored. And so the two subvariants were probably coexisting, one more mutated than the other. But I can tell you it's very likely that if one had either BA1 or BA2, they have immunity against both, since the strains have such a great degree of homology. BA2, because of the spike protein is a little bit more intact, it will be a little bit more infectious and potentially more virulent. And BA2 can be a dominant in some pockets. We've seen this in Europe. But that's the story on BA2. The Deltacron is interesting because there was a clash between Delta and Omicron. The two strains were fighting for dominance. And we know with Omicron, it just out-replicated Delta about 70-fold faster. And then it closed the immunologic door on Delta by raising immunity against Delta if you got Omicron. Now there's Deltacron, which is probably a fusion with a variety of replication mistakes where it has some characteristics of Delta and some of Omicron. We'll have to keep a watch on this. Clearly, immunity to either one of these is going to provide cross immunity, but I'm slightly worried about Deltacron only because if it's Delta, if it has the virulence of Delta, which was very hard. I mean, I've been fighting the virus for 2 years with leading doctors as we treat patients. Delta was one of the hardest. And if Delta now picks up some of the contagious properties of Omicron, this could be worrisome. So we're going to keep a careful watch on that. And again, emphasizes we need to have early treatment programs. Boy, Australia and New Zealand ought to be ready with monoclonal antibodies. The new Pfizer drug, Paxlovid, works great. Be ready with corticosteroids, anticoagulants.
A lot of people are very, very reluctant to go anywhere near anything that Pfizer's produced after seeing the hiding of the data, hiding of the safety data, lying to health authorities. Are we sure that this new drug isn't going to cause some sort of problems like their vaccines did, Dr. McCullough?
You know, I'm really disappointed in what's happened. And it's sad because there's been a global loss of confidence across the board. And, you know, I've been involved in pandemic response reviews now for a variety of news sources and other roundtables. And I give a mixed report. While the Pfizer vaccine has been an unqualified disaster and there hasn't been transparency on reporting, I think the Pfizer drug Paxlovid is a clear winner. And the clinical trials show Paxlovid is clearly safe and effective. It's got a lot of drug interactions we have to worry about. It's interesting because the package insert for the Paxlovid Pfizer drug lists all the warnings. It's loaded with warnings. And yet the Pfizer vaccine is very light on any warnings or cautions whatsoever in the EUA FAQ. But the Pfizer product is very good. Now, the Merck product, molnupiravir, a different story. There are papers written about its mutagenicity and that it inhibits polymerases of the virus, but also of human cells, and is thought to be likely to be oncogenic. So there's only a 5-day course of treatment, but people prone to cancer are going to be worried. The Pfizer drug's only 30% effective, the Merck drug's only 30% effective, where Pfizer is over 80% effective. So I think we have to keep that in mind. We still have sotrovimab, the monoclonal antibody by GSK, recent clinical study. I just tweeted out in my feed, and I believe it's called the Comet ICE study. Showed a really incredible efficacy. It was so impressive. This paper that just hit the wires by Anil Gupta and colleagues in JAMA, it's called an effect of sotrovimab on hospitalization and death among high risk with mild to moderate COVID-19. This is really impressive. This monoclonal antibody given as an outpatient had a 79% reduction in hospitalization and death. The p-value was less than 0.001. All the other secondary outcomes were statistically significant. This drug's a winner. This is a GlaxoSmithKline product. Lilly's got another product called botulinumtoxinA. And I can tell you the monoclonal antibodies are safe and effective. We should be cheering regarding the progress of medical science there. So it's not all bad. It is not all bad at all. It turned out the vaccines just turned out to be a bad branch of this biotech development, but we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's going to be some severe cases, and I've had a few patients say, listen, I don't want anything to do with Pfizer, and I said, please be fair, because I think the Pfizer drug really is safe and effective, and I want my patients to get it, but they've lost their trust.
How do we know that the studies that they've done are actually true, that the numbers that they're giving us around the effectiveness, considering they told us the vaccines were 90% effective? Have there been further studies, independent reviews conducted on this particular drug that you're talking about that we can sort of say, oh, well, that sounds a bit more trustworthy?
There is a trials program and it's formative. But the good news here is that the mechanism of actions are really well known. For instance, ritonavir, we've used that for a long time in HIV. We understand how the protease inhibitors work. And we know it's only 5 days of therapy. The kinase-like 3 inhibitor, nelfenpiravir, is reasonably well understood. These are basically repurposed drugs. They're, in a sense, like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin were repurposed. These are repurposed drugs into a combination product. The clinical trial involved several thousand people. I thought it was pretty convincing. The safety data was cohesive. With the genetic vaccines, it was a different story. You know, genetic vaccines, we had never used large-scale lipid nanoparticle technology, the messenger RNA and the adenoviral DNA. It had been around a while, but it had always been unsuccessful or unsafe. And only 2 months of observation, as opposed to standard vaccine needs 2 years of observation. And then genetic technology like these, they need 5 years of observation. All that was skipped. Most of us knew these vaccines were going to be risky out of the gate. I published an op-ed in The Hill, a Washington Insider Journal, in the summer before the vaccines were released. And I said the great gamble of the COVID-19 vaccine pandemic. I said, listen, this is risky. This is risky business. And if we're going to use a vaccine, it better be just in our elderly or in those at very high risk so we can carefully evaluate safety. We would not want to vaccinate the entire population with a brand new technology like this, because if it goes bad, it's going to go bad and result in lots of injuries and deaths, and that's what we've seen.
They're talking about now, I heard Birla recently talking about using mRNA technology for things like cancer. Do you know if there have been further improvements to mRNA technology since this huge blunder, or should people really steer clear until more research is done?
It depends on what people are talking about. You know, in my circles as a cardiologist, there have been three RNA products, and they're what's called small interfering RNAs or antisense oligonucleotides is another term. And the first one is called mipomersen, and this one interfered with the protein production of the protein coding for ApoB, which is on LDL cholesterol. And then the second one was patirisan. Patirisan is used to try to reduce the production of what's called amyloid protein in amyloidosis. And now the third one that's just been released in cardiology is called inclisiran, and this interferes with the production of ApoB. And there's a future one to interfere with the production of lipoprotein little a. The point is, we're using RNA products in order to shut off production of something. That's very different than using RNA products to produce an abnormal protein. And that's what Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca, they take over the body to produce an abnormal protein, in this case, the lethal spike protein of the virus. It's a very bad idea. And you know, Moderna's announced that they want to have 15 different messenger RNA vaccines. And so if the body is going to be loaded with these that are producing pathogenic proteins like the spike protein, I can't imagine how the human body is going to be able to survive this onslaught of genetic material. The other disturbing thing is that the genetic material is not getting out of the body. And to find it in lymph nodes several months later, this is very disturbing. To find it incorporating into human DNA, everything we've learned about the vaccine since the release is bad. Everything, from the preclinical sciences all the way through failed safety, dramatic safety concerns, and now failed efficacies. It's a 100% bad story since the release.
Totally agree with you. And a lot of people have concerns around the spike proteins passing through breast milk from a mother to her baby. And are we seeing evidence of that now? Have we got something to suggest that they should avoid getting vaccinated when they're pregnant or about to give birth?
I think the FDA was right to begin with. The FDA in the clinical trials excluded pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, breastfeeding women specifically, because they weren't going to be safe in this population. So if they're excluded from the clinical trials, I think women should take that as a cue. They're not going to be safe. In a paper by Banzel and colleagues, they've shown that the spike protein clearly can travel in the body through what's called exosomes or little phospholipid packets. And this is the mechanism by which how it gets into sweat, into various kind of oral urogenital secretions, and almost certainly into breast milk. And Dr. Harvey Risch from Yale presented a clinical vignette on national TV, and I was on the program at the same time, where a woman who was breastfeeding and taking the vaccine and was breastfeeding, a few days later, the baby died of a hemorrhagic death. And, you know, we just don't see babies dying of these horrific syndromes like this. And the postulate is that, in fact, the spike protein was being transmitted through the breast milk to the baby. Now, remember, a breastfeeding woman is steering clear of alcohol, caffeine, or anything else. It should be common sense to the breastfeeding woman that she should not take a genetic injection that codes for the dangerous Wuhan spike protein. A woman ought to display some common sense that she would never do that to her body. And same thing in a woman being pregnant. Pregnant women, you know, read every food label to make sure that they're not taking in a substance that could harm the baby. You know, a pregnant woman under no circumstances should consider taking a genetic injection that codes for the Wuhan spike protein, which is known to be pathogenic, cause blood clotting, that the FDA said specifically pregnant women should not get the vaccines in the randomized trials. There ought to be strong cues to women to just stay clear of these vaccines. And I think sadly, they're being forced into this. Their gynecologists are telling them to take it. You know, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, without considering safety, has advised that pregnant women take the vaccines. And I can tell you doctors in my circle, Dr. Ray Stricker, and I published in TrialSite News that under no circumstances should a pregnant woman ever take one of these vaccines. It's pregnancy category X, meaning it has a dangerous mechanism of action, and we have no reassuring safety data whatsoever. We have no randomized trial data that's efficacious. Now, people say, wait a minute, Dr. McCullough, pregnancy is a dangerous predisposing factor for COVID. It's not true. There's a paper by Pinellas and colleagues, another one by Winkies and colleagues recently in JAMA, showing pregnant women actually have great outcomes with COVID-19. Even if they're hospitalized, there is a very low risk of death. It's very treatable at home. A pregnant woman should not consider herself vulnerable or immunodeficient. In fact, pregnancy is a robust state of immune defense. Today in my practice, I had a woman who is breastfeeding, and she had COVID through the pregnancy, and for her, it was like a breeze. She fought it off easily. Pregnant women's bodies are resilient.
That's very reassuring, I think, for a lot of pregnant women, because they're being given completely different information. They're being told they're greatly at risk, more at risk when they're pregnant from COVID-19. And so I think that they'll appreciate that reassurance, Dr. McCullough. A lot of people also have questions about shedding, and I know that this has been a topic that we keep finding out a little bit more at a time, but have we got specific papers to talk to us about shedding? Do we know how people can protect themselves from shedding?
The only papers I can quote are by Banzel showing the exosome presence. They actually physically showed the spike protein traveling in the body. And then a review paper by Stephanie Senoff at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, really, in a sense, providing a theoretical framework that shedding could happen. But there still hasn't been a paper proving that shedding, transference of spike protein and exosomes goes from one person to another, resulting in clinically meaningful outcomes. So it hasn't been proven yet. Having talked to probably many hundreds, if not thousands of people regarding this topic, and seeing hundreds and hundreds of patients myself, probably seeing several thousand myself, I am unconvinced that shedding is a significant concern. I think it's theoretically possible. The most demonstrable thing I've seen in my practice is a young man who took the vaccine had close contact with a young woman, and the young woman expressed shingles. She had a case of shingles on her back, which you just don't see in a young, healthy woman. So, it's possible that could happen. My general advice is if someone takes the vaccine, they should be respectful. They should refrain from any kissing or sexual contact for about a month. Now, that'll get the attention of the young kids if you give that advice. And the other thing I tell people, listen, under no circumstances, no donation of blood, because we now know the spike protein could be circulatory for a month. And the last thing someone wants to do is donate a unit of blood and lace it with spike protein, which could be deadly for the recipient.
And the people that are accepting this blood, are they checking whether people have been vaccinated in the past month? Are they checking the blood before they give it to someone else?
You know, the blood donation centers have really let us down. They've been notified of this concern. They haven't done anything about it. The only thing they've said is that a vaccinated person their blood doesn't have strong enough antibodies to actually be a donor for convalescent plasma. Only COVID recovered patients can do that. But now that we have monoclonal antibodies that look terrific, even the convalescent plasma is being phased out. So we're just left with the issue of contaminating the blood supply. And in my view, the blood donation centers months ago should restrict people from donating blood within 30 days of taking a vaccine. And if they're not going to do it, I think the people taking the vaccine should be responsible enough. There's enough knowledge out there. There's enough awareness. I think people who are going to take the vaccine should be, you know, they should be knowledgeable that they've taken something into their body, that their body's producing the spike protein. The spike protein is lethal and dangerous to themselves and others. They're going to have to start showing respect for other people who are wisely refraining from the vaccines.
I want to finish on a good note, Dr. McCullough, for you to tell us about some of the progress that you and your colleagues are making in the United States and the way that you see the tide is turning despite what we see in the mainstream media.
Well, the good news is, you know, the vaccine mandates reached a particular climax in the Supreme Court, and in the progress of the cases all the way up to the Supreme Court, Judge Doughty in the Sixth Circuit Court relied on my testimony and that of Dr. Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford in overturning the Biden mandates. And then the Supreme Court went ahead and overturned 4 out of the 5 Biden mandates. The only one that stays is the one for healthcare workers because of what's called strings attached, meaning that some federal money goes to healthcare, so the healthcare organizations have to have a vaccine program. But that means by and large, all the private businesses, everyone else is free of the vaccines. Now, some of the private businesses are still mandating the vaccine as a part of at-will employment, but that is strongly challenged by workers who say, listen, the Supreme Court ruled against it. The World Health Organization is not advising it. CDC is not advising mandates, and that nobody wants them. They're very unpopular. You know, I spoke at the Defeat the Mandates rally in Washington, American Homecoming on January 23rd, and I was on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. I gave the very first speech to America, and I looked out over thousands and thousands of people in the crowd, and I listened, and I didn't hear any counter protesters, none, no hecklers. And I can tell you, Maria, nobody wants this vaccine. No one's supporting the vaccine. No one. And so the sentiment is really turned against the vaccines. The Canadian truckers really, you know, made the case, and they had tremendous community support. Nobody wanted these vaccines. And so the quicker the governments drop the vaccine mandates and go back to normal, the better we are. But, you know, it's way different now. We've got way more therapeutics and very acceptable therapeutics to all government authorities since they brought them forward. We need to drop the emergency measures. The emergency is over. That's good news. We can drop the mandates. That's good news. And I think we should pull the vaccines off the market and analyze them for safety. All the vaccine manufacturers say they're going to have new versions out before the end of this month. We need to start pulling Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, and then analyze why were they so dangerous? Why did people die after the vaccines? Senator Johnson has just introduced with Senator Cruz and others a compensation program for those injured by the vaccines. That's been officially introduced as legislation. And, you know, there's more and more positive developments around medical freedom because where there's risk, and there's clearly risk with the vaccines, there must be choice. And, you know, the risks that are acknowledged are myocarditis and heart inflammation by the regulatory authorities, blood clots in the brain, Guillain-Barré syndrome, paralysis. These are real risks. So if there are risks, there must be choice. And I think everybody can agree on that.
I really, really hope that Australian doctors start taking a leaf out of your book, Dr. McCullough, and others who are so bravely leading the way in this. The United States has made so much progress, whereas in Australia, we're still talking about mandating further doses. It's unbelievable. And Australian doctors are so afraid to speak out. Yet look how much headway you've made and your colleagues in the United States. We need that bravery here from the Australian medical profession now, because it looks like Australia is wanting to keep pushing this ahead. And we can't, mandating further doses. Come on. We can't be doing this anymore. It's done.
Yeah.
It's over.
Yeah, now is a time for courage and intellectual courage, and Australian doctors need to really just do a deep gut check here. They've watched 2 years of this. They've watched some of their patients get slaughtered by the virus while they haven't treated it. Now they're watching people become injured, in fact, dying of the vaccine. You know, doctors are going to have to come out at some point in time. These two dark chapters have to be closed, and we've got to just treat people as they come forward with COVID-19 and stop the vaccine program. And it does take courage. And I got to tell you what, we need more doctors with courage right now. And it's not physical courage or what have you. It's actually intellectual courage. They have to have the intellectual, moral, ethical, and clinical courage to make the right call.
I agree with you. Thank you for being the example of that. Dr. McCullough, we thank you so much for your time today. We'll speak to you again in the future. And in the description, I've linked where you can follow Dr. McCullough on Twitter and also a link to the McCullough Report, which is on iHeart there. Thank you again, Dr. McCullough.
Thank you, Maria.
This, you know, the doctor's oath is to do no harm. Absolutely important that a doctor is only considering the patient right in front of them. How many deaths is okay? How many deaths by a vaccination are acceptable? Well, there are a lot of doctors getting passionate about this conversation. None more maybe than my next guest, Dr. Peter McCullough. This is him in a Senate meeting with Ron Johnson just a few weeks ago.
I'm telling you, as a specialist, myocarditis is not mild. There are papers by Schauer and by Truong at University of Utah at Salt Lake. When they do MRI on these individuals with suspected myocarditis, 100% are having heart damage. There is the father of a boy here in this room who's died of myocarditis. One death, too many. One. We have 21,000 cases of myocarditis and climbing in the United States that the CDC has verified. One was too many. Under no circumstances, under any circumstances, should a young person ever receive one of these vaccines, let alone ever be pressured to receive a vaccine, let alone ever be mandated to take a vaccine.
Passionate and powerful testimony by Dr. Peter McCullough. That was at the Ron Johnson Senate hearing. It is my honor and pleasure to be joined now by Dr. Peter McCullough. First of all, we have had you Zoom in and Skype in, and I've, of course, been with you out speaking on stages, but it is just so incredible to have you here inside the High Wire studio, so I want to thank you for making the trip in to talk with us today.
Well, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
I want to just start out with, take me back to just from the beginning. What would your perspective, before COVID, before any of this happened, what is your perspective of vaccines and, you know, and medicine, you know, around that topic?
Yeah, I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist. I'm trained as an epidemiologist and spend about half my time in clinical practice, half as an author and editor and a clinical investigator. Vaccines were really never in my academic scope, and I never questioned them, and my parents never questioned them. So as a child, I took the vaccines according to the schedule, and when I was asked to take one, I took one. My wife and I went to India a few years ago. We went to the public health department. We took additional vaccines. And, you know, I had the general understanding that they were safe and effective,
mm-hmm.
And take them as offered. And I had the general understanding that they worked to suppress the recurrence of a disease like polio, that they worked to suppress the frequency of a disease, like getting tetanus if I had a wound infection, and that they offered some personal protection. I think of the vaccine in my life that came in as a new entry that was meaningful was hepatitis B.
Okay.
So I trained during an era where we were unprotected from hepatitis B. So if I would have gotten a needle stick from a patient who had active hepatitis B, I could have contracted it myself. So that was my general understanding.
Okay. And, you know, can I just ask you, in all of your education, how much of that education, just going through medicine, your end up in a heart specialty, did you focus on vaccination? What would you say for someone that just doesn't know? Like, we just have this assumption that doctors really have a deep understanding of vaccination because it's a foundational principle of modern medicine, is it not? So what was it? Just describe the education system around it that you had.
Well, in undergraduate, we have some courses in immunology and microbiology, general biology, pathophysiology. And then in medical school, again, we have not only microbiology, but we can have certain units in virology, have specific courses on public health. But, you know, I don't recall a distinct section on vaccines. I don't recall anything more than a test question here or there on vaccines. I think they're generally accepted as safe and effective.
There's a Heidi Larson, sort of one of the sort of head figures of the WHO, especially when it comes to the psychology around the work that they do. In a large meeting, she said to a group of doctors, let's face it, your average doctor or nurse in medical school are lucky if they get a half a day education on vaccinations.
Most medical school curriculums, even nursing curriculums, I mean, in medical school, you're lucky if you have a half day on vaccines, never mind keeping up to date with all this.
Do you think that's an accurate statement?
I agree.
Okay. All right. So then COVID, this pandemic, what was your first response and thoughts?
You know, I had enough connectivity to what was going on and communications from New York and particularly from Milan and Tuscany, where while it wasn't certainly bad here in Texas, it was bad elsewhere. Okay. And I got very activated. In fact, with my division chief, we decided to embark on one of the first hydroxychloroquine studies. We got a grant. We got the drug supply coming in. We organized my entire research team, which is focused on heart and kidney disease, to change their focus towards an infectious disease, SARS-CoV-2, the virus, COVID-19, the illness. I got an investigation and a drug application with the FDA. Did that over a weekend,
okay.
And it was for the use
of... What time period are we talking about?
This is March.
March.
I think the IND number was awarded my name March 30th.
March 30th
so I got,
of 2020.
Of 2020.
Okay.
And so I got busy early. We embarked on this, and I remember being on some health system task force calls. And in fact, I was on one call with the National Institutes of Health, and the commentary was typically about the healthcare workers, about negative pressure rooms, personal protective equipment, hand sanitizer, use of masks. And I think on one of these calls, I remember asking the question, are we going to start treating this illness? And it was dead silence. It was just no one had an idea. And I went home that night and I thought about it. I said, this is the opportunity. No one is thinking about treating COVID. No one is thinking about it. So communicated with my colleagues in Italy, and they said, well, you know, we think there are some drugs at work. I was watching what was going on in Marseille, France with Didier Reault. I wasn't aware of Vladimir Zlenko at the time. I wasn't aware of Pierre Corey and Paul Merrick. But I embarked with largely with Italian colleagues, with Dr. Ladepo at UCLA, Dr. Risch at Yale, which we quickly bonded with some colleagues at Emory, and put together the very first paper that says there is a rationale to treat COVID to prevent hospitalization and death. We worked on that in May and June of 2020. The paper was launched to American Journal of Medicine on July 1st, and then it actually was went through the peer review process, fully accepted, and published August 7th of 2020. Now, I would have went to New England Journal. I had previously published in New England Journal in Lancet. I thought a breakthrough paper could be there, but there were two things that happened. There was a fraudulent paper published in Lancet.
Yep.
On hydroxychloroquine, and there was a fraudulent paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine on ACE inhibitors, which is another topic of interest, from a fake database, a Surgisphere database.
Yeah,
I started to get a sense that, wait a minute, things aren't going right.
And that's the paper that ultimately is retracted, just for the audience.
Right.
Lancet had to retract it because Surgisphere could not provide any data
when
doctors, and I imagine you were one of them, questioning, where's your data coming from? What's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, how could a database exist back from December, January, February, March, having tens of thousands of people claiming that people in their 40s were being hospitalized with the mean age in the tables was 40. We're hospitalized people in their 80s,
right?
Not in their 40s. So the whole thing looked like it was fraudulent. But the fraudulent claim was that there was an excess risk, a slight, it wasn't much actually in that paper, excess risk with hydroxychloroquine, which turned out to be not to be proven correctly. But what was going on as we were communicating early in 2020, Henry Ford did a big early treatment study in the hospital with hydroxychloroquine, 3,000 patients, consented, high quality data, showing hydroxychloroquine associated with a reduced risk of mortality when used early in the hospital. I previously was a program director at Henry Ford. I had colleagues there. We were communicating, and I got a call from Peter Navarro in the White House in the spring of 2020 saying, listen, we are stuck, that there was an emergency use authorization put on hydroxychloroquine, effectively restricting it. In fact, if there was no emergency use authorization, it didn't need one. It was already a fully FDA-approved drug.
Let me understand this. So are you saying that had they just left hydroxychloroquine alone and just never dealt with it, that it could have been used because it was already approved?
A lot of us initially thought emergency use authorization, oh, it's authorizing us to use it. But then we realized, wait a minute, no, it's not. In fact, this is making it difficult to use as an outpatient potentially. And sure enough, then the FDA in the summer of 2020 let the hammer down. They said, no, we're not going to expand emergency use authorization. In fact, hydroxychloroquine should not be used to treat COVID-19, should not. That statement came out in the summer of 2020. It was never revisited. There were now, since that time, hundreds of hydroxychloroquine studies
wow.
that came in. It was never revisited. So I learned something. I learned something that our regulatory agencies were not going to commit to a regular review of new products. And actually, since this has happened, we have not had regular review on any products in COVID-19.
Do you feel like the EUA that was put on hydroxychloroquine was on purpose to restrict it, or do you think it was just an accidental byproduct of perhaps just bad thinking?
I think it's accidental.
Yeah, okay. So at what point, so hydroxychloroquine, you're involved in that, you watch this terrible study come out. Now the media fairly early on is against it. Tony Fauci, the first time I hear, you know, that we were actually reporting on hydroxychloroquine, we're looking at Didier Raoult in France and talking about that. But the second Donald Trump says it, Fauci seems already bent on saying, I don't trust it, it hasn't been through double-blind placebo studies. And the media just always seemed to have a bend against it. When you were one of the first, you're one of the first doing the studies with it, you're recognizing that you're being told out of Italy, there seems to be some success with this. Did something seem off with the media's sort of reporting on this?
Yeah, it seemed clear that, of course, it's natural to be critical of sure. Smaller studies. But I distinctly remember a question was directed to Fauci and said, if you had a patient right in front of you now with acute COVID-19, would you treat them with hydroxychloroquine? Mm-hmm. The historical newsreels will pull this one. Answer, yes.
If you're a doctor listening to me right now and a patient with coronavirus feels like maybe they want to try that, and you're their doctor, you're not Anthony Fauci, the guy running the coronavirus task force right now, would you say, all right, we'll give it a whirl?
Yeah, of course. I mean, particularly if people have no other option, you want to give them hope. In fact, physicians in this country, these drugs are approved drugs for other reasons. They're anti-malaria drugs, and they're drugs against certain autoimmune diseases like lupus. Physicians throughout the country can prescribe that in an off-label way, which means they can write it for something that it was not originally approved for.
And those words were uttered. Now, quickly, there was backpedaling, and you're right, it became political. But the interesting thing is it became political all over the world
yeah.
at once. You know, early in April in Australia, got on the books, may not use hydroxychloroquine. If one uses hydroxychloroquine, punishable by imprisonment or fine. In Marseille, France, was over-the-counter, becomes prescription. Now it's not so readily available. Then there's more activity. A hydroxychloroquine plant outside of Taipei burns to the ground. Stockpiles were created in Australia, United States, and then the hydroxychloroquine is never released. United States Association of American Physicians and Surgeons sues to release the stockpile. Don't hog
Hoard
the,
it,
the
right.
stockpile.
Yeah.
And to this day, now it turns out hydroxychloroquine, I published the meta-analysis with Ladapo on this, is still in the preprint server system. It has about a 25% effect size, about a 25% benefit.
Okay.
It's not a mega benefit, but it's about a 20. It's modestly beneficial. Over 300 supportive studies now. There's actually a 28,000 patient study out of Iran, observational study, but very well done observation, you know, demonstrating a large enough population, there is a meaningful reduction in hospitalization and death when applied in high-risk patients, when applied early. And it's safe.
Right.
But it's interesting how hydroxychloroquine which is now in over 30 countries in the official government recommendations to use it, in probably about 50 to 60 NGOs that officially endorse hydroxychloroquine, how in the first few months of hydroxychloroquine use, all we heard was hydroxychloroquine was dangerous for the heart.
Right.
And now, 2 years later, we don't hear a word about hydroxychloroquine and dangerous for the heart. But how I characterize it is the first year of the pandemic was largely the year of hydroxychloroquine. The second year of the pandemic was largely the year of ivermectin. And the third year of the pandemic will probably be the year, if we continue to have cases, of the new EUA oral drugs, the Pfizer and Merck drugs. But this is natural in medicine. We use what's available to us at the time.
Now, this whole time, this attack on hydroxychloroquine, what we were reporting here is we thought it was interesting that, too, we're being told this vaccine, that the vaccine, I mean, Fauci is saying the vaccine is going to be the only way to end this pandemic. We're hearing the same thing from Bill Gates and Trudeau and people all over the world repeating this statement, our only way out of the pandemic is going to be a vaccine. When was the first time you heard that, and what were your thoughts about that idea? You are obviously doing investigation into a repurposed drug, you know. So this idea that there's going to be no drug that will work, vaccine is our only way out.
The landmark that I recall is I was a regular contributor in The Hill, which is a political journal,
okay. And
I was asked by someone there to contribute. And I started contributing early on in the pandemic and making the case that we actually do need access for hydroxychloroquine, in fact, multiple drugs. But it was in the summer of 2020, I published an op-ed in The Hill, and I said, the great gamble of the COVID-19 vaccine development program. So I put a stake in the ground before the clinical trials were ever done.
Okay.
And what I said is, I said, listen, this is rushing through development. We don't have a great track record for vaccines against respiratory illnesses.
Yep.
And the chances are it's not going to be safe enough or it's going to be effective enough. And I think I was more levered on efficacy than safety. But the reason why I published this op-ed is because we had technology coming forward for the first time that was genetic, that was not just an antigen-based vaccine. It
right.
wasn't a whole virus vaccine. It wasn't a live attenuated or an inactivated virus, that it was genetic, and that the mechanism was going to load genetic material on lipid nanoparticles, which were known to go everywhere in the body. This was published beforehand, and it was known that they were going to go to the adrenal glands, the ovaries, the reproductive organs, the brain. Lipid nanoparticles cross the blood-brain barrier. For the first time, we're going to have vaccines go in the human brain. This was known ahead of time. And that there was going to be a genetic payload. And the payload, this was the messenger RNA. It was interesting. It doesn't need the nucleus. The messenger RNA is going to come into the cells. It's going to go into the cytoplasm, the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and it's simply going to use the ribosomes that are there. The ribosomes are there. They're going to pick up this messenger RNA as the next piece, and they were going to transcribe and produce the spike protein,
right?
The bud on the surface of the virus. So once we started to realize that the pathogenicity of the virus is coming from the spike protein, the organ system damage, the cellular damage, the endothelial damage.
The worst part
blood,
of the virus.
The worst part.
Right. Is what, and, I mean, because I always say, I mean, mostly vaccines, as we look at them, sort of takes a weaker part of the virus. Should it spread, it wouldn't be. It's not like it's not the weapon of the virus. This is the weapon of the virus being recreated
this
by
was,
itself.
And actually, as the learning came out in 2020, and certainly in 2021, actually, this was the lethal part of the virus.
Right.
So the analogy could be tetanus, the tetanus toxoid, the toxin. Well, if you gave a tiny bit of it in a controlled setting, you could form immunity to it, but not overwhelm the body with tetanus toxoid. Mm-hmm. That's how the tetanus shot works.
Yeah.
With a hepatitis B, it's really nice. You pick a, in a sense, the surface antigen. It's not going to cause any type of hepatitis. Surface antigen is just going to give you immunity. That's it. But this was the spike protein, which was, we were learning, was going to be, in a sense, the loaded weapon. And the genetic mechanism means that we could not control where it was going to be produced in the body, the quantity that was going to be produced, or the duration that was going to be produced. That's the gamble. Think about that. Where it's going to be produced, quantity,
and duration. So what
we are not, just to be clear for the audience, that we're not injecting the amount we want in the body. We're sending a message and letting the body produce as much of this as you see your cells. How many cells are going to start producing it? No idea what cells are going to produce it, where in the body, you know, and then how long it'll be producing until it stops. So total unknowns, complete and total unknowns.
Think about the intellectual gamble. Think about explaining that to somebody a few years later.
Right.
That we were going to give this a spin.
Yeah.
And we're not just going to do it in a small number of people and carefully control this and observe this. We were going to do this wide open.
When it was finally starting to release and you're watching these trials, what was the first place you really felt like there was a red flag as far as safety?
First thing was when the regulatory standards changed. So vaccines, the conventional, so live attenuated, inactivated, and protein-based vaccines, 2 years of observational safety data. Anything related to genetics, so a small interfering messenger RNA, gene therapy, which we've tried in my field before, 5 years.
Okay.
5 years. So truncated to a 2-month clinical trial, you know, 2 months is not going to be enough to see safety. Now we have, there's a preclinical paper that just came out, and first author, I believe, is Rothkin, that has demonstrated the messenger RNA is physically in the human body in lymph nodes for months. So to have safety observed for 2 months in a registrational trial, but have the product physically be in the body, the foreign product, which is the nucleoside yeah. analog caps and the RNA, for beyond the duration of safety is extraordinarily concerning. And then the data broke with Bruce Patterson, who leads Incell DX, where Bruce showed in the respiratory infection, the spike protein, the S1 segment, is in human CD16 positive monocytes for up to 15 months after the respiratory infection. Then Banzel publishes that the spike protein after vaccination is traveling in the body in what's called exosomes, or small phospholipid packets. Now we know the spike protein's on the move in the body independently. And then I have Bruce come on the McCullough Report for America Out Loud Talk Radio. I said, Bruce, I need to know, because he has a registry of people who've taken the vaccine, and he has the ability to detect the spike protein. And I asked Bruce the question, and it's in the recording. Bruce, what are you seeing? He's saying, I'm seeing the S1 and the S2 segment in vaccinated people for as long as I can observe them. Months. And I asked him, Bruce, how long is this spike protein going to stay in the body? His best estimate is certainly more than a year.
Now, why is that a problem? Because I think your average person is listening right now thinking, well, I want my antibodies to last forever. We're not talking about the antibodies. So why is it?
We're talking about the dangerous spike protein. And the question is, where is it in the body? So when the autopsy studies broke of vaccinated people who had taken the vaccine and they short died a few months afterwards, they came from Vienna and they came from Germany, the answer was it's everywhere. The spike protein is in the brain. It's in the heart. It's
so we're not talking the antibodies to the spike protein. We are talking about the weapon of the virus, the dangerous inflammatory cytokine inspiring, you know,
blood clotting. It's the most
it's all over the body.
Right. So, I mean, you could take, everyone understands this. Blood clots in the body are a bad thing.
Yeah.
The spike protein, it's incontrovertible. It causes blood clotting. Every single study shows that. It damages endothelial cells. I've published papers with Zhang and colleagues demonstrating the spike protein damages endothelial cells. People have the hardest time figuring out, is it the virus with the spike protein, or the spike protein alone can it damage things? And once we started getting the preclinical papers saying, forget the nucleocapsid, just the spike protein alone, when we give that in models, does it damage cells? Does it cause blood clotting?
Right.
Does it damage the heart? The answer is yes. Independently, the spike protein is pathogenic.
And they brag, essentially, that the vaccine causes more spike protein throughout the body and thus to create, ramp up the antibody production than a natural infection, right? I mean, the load is much higher.
It would be okay if the spike protein was benign. So it is true. It is true that the antibodies in the natural infection have a blunted curve against the spike protein, the nucleocapsid. And then after the vaccines, the antibodies are, you know, 5 to 10 times higher. So it is true. So what we'd infer, if the antibody response is so much higher after the vaccine, the human body systemically must have been exposed to so much more spike protein.
Right.
That's concerning, because in the respiratory infection, if we're able to battle off the virus in the sinuses and the upper respiratory tract, we don't get much spike protein exposure.
Right.
Whether you get the respiratory infection or the vaccine, there is some degree of an installation of something foreign in the human body.
So to your average person that's trying to decide between those two things, well, it sounds like natural infection lasts a long time. The vaccine seems to have, is it the same? How do we make this decision? We're trying to fight something. I don't want to have it forever. People are getting the vaccine to try and avoid that, yet it's filled with the S1, the spike protein that's the bad guy and lasting forever.
The first thing that comes to my mind is dose.
Dose.
Is dose. It'd be best to not get any of this stuff,
okay,
right? So it'd be wonderful if you never got the virus, you never got exposed to the spike protein through the vaccine, and that, you know, it was like before COVID. That
right.
would be great. I had a patient recently, took the vaccines because she had to for her job. She's in her 50s, thin, active, and around December or so, she gets COVID-19. She languishes and she languishes and she languishes. So she's had the vaccine. She's fully vaccinated. She gets COVID, which is now
right.
understood to be common.
Yep.
She gets COVID, and I want to say between the second or third week, blood clot. She gets a pulmonary embolus, and now she's committed to blood thinners. The thought came into my mind, she's already been preloaded with spike protein with shot one and shot two. Now she's got the third dose with the respiratory infection.
Wow.
And she ends up with a blood clot. It does make me wonder, in all these cases of complications after the vaccine, how many people have been pre-installed with the respiratory infection and they get additional spike protein with the vaccine? The thought has come into my mind, it's frustrating because I filled out these VAERS forms clinically and there's no checkbox to say the patient previously had COVID.
Right.
So the CDC will never
know. So maybe accumulating in some way we can look at an infection as a dose, and you're just sort of adding this accumulation of this dangerous spike protein. No matter how you're approaching it naturally or through an injection, you are stockpiling something that's really bad for your body.
I mean, everything we've just talked about, honestly, has become known within the last few months.
Wow. All right, because we could probably sit here all day, let me go ahead and dive really into what's got you on the talk circuit, speaking to news agencies all over, myocarditis, pericarditis. First of all, just briefly, prior to the vaccine, how much interaction did you have with this concept of myocarditis?
It came up rarely.
Okay.
In the last 3 decades, I can think of a handful of cases. I can think of one fatal case that was in my circles that happened to a dean at a medical school. So it can happen. Myocarditis can happen. There are some viruses that can cause it. It's very much what we consider a very rare condition.
Okay.
So there's a paper from Finland that's useful. It's published recently, before COVID, but recently, looking at myocarditis, which tends to be a problem of young people. You never hear somebody in nursing home getting myocarditis. It's
okay.
a young person's disease. But they looked at people, I want to say below age 20 in Finland, the whole country, they have a very good national registry, before COVID,
yep.
how much myocarditis was out there. And they showed almost none in children before puberty. And then after puberty, there's a rise. About 90% of it was in boys, 10% in girls. So there must be something with puberty and androgens related. Again, before COVID.
Right.
And the rate, though, was 4 cases per million. 4 cases per million.
Okay.
So you can think of this in the United States, if we have, what's the number of children, 70 million?
I would say 75 million,
okay,
somewhere
70.
In there, 70, 75, 70.
Let's right. say 70.
Yeah,
so that means
sure.
280 cases
right.
of myocarditis could pop up. It could be a parvovirus, adenovirus, rare cases of what's called giant cell myocarditis. That's the bad one. That one's fatal. I had one of those in my circles. That's fatal. It's completely idiopathic. But people still ask the question, what happens when you get it? And there is a recent paper by Tashopi and colleagues in Circulation Research that suggests in these cases of myocarditis, again, before COVID, that about a third took substantial damage to the heart and didn't completely recover. You know, there was a hit mm-hmm. and it didn't come back completely.
Yeah.
And then 13% were really damaged, in fact, could get worse.
Okay.
So the point is, it wasn't one of these things that you get in and out of before COVID.
Right.
Okay, so we knew that from prognosis. Now, okay. Fast forward to COVID, and as the story broke in June of 2021, the CDC had a universe of cases of several hundred cases, let's say less than 1,000, but several hundred cases,
yeah.
But didn't have much data, ultimately got down to around about 200 cases that they could adjudicate. And they looked at this and said, listen, that 90% of these people who got there were young people, that they were hospitalized. So we, you know, that's by definition, by regulatory definition, that's a serious adverse event.
Right. You're hospitalized.
SAE, a serious, right. Hospitalized or died, that's serious. About a quarter had abnormal echocardiograms, inferring that they had reduced left ventricular function. They had EKG changes, positive troponins. They met a clinical definition. And I was asked to go on national TV around about that time, and the story broke. And the CDC and FDA, which they had actually a joint meeting, they used the terms rare and they used the terms mild. And I immediately bristled at that, and I said, listen, it can't be mild because they're hospitalized. So it's,
right.
By definition, it's serious. We cannot say something that's serious is mild. Anything that lands your child in the hospital is serious.
Right.
The second point was that it was rare. I said, well, they can't say it's rare. They had tried to divide among this giant population of adults who took the vaccine. I said, this is just becoming known, and the children were just starting to be vaccinated.
So basically, it was affecting the children. We had millions and millions of adults who had already received the vaccine, and as soon as we started seeing this myocarditis issue, they put it in context of the entire body of people that had been vaccinated instead of focusing on the group that it was affecting. So they watered down the numbers essentially by, you know, distributing amongst people that weren't at risk for myocarditis. If you just focus on the kids, like barely any kids have gotten this, and we're seeing huge signals, you can't say it's rare.
Right, and that was actually in the CDC slides. I was on one of the calls,
yep.
And it just, it was obvious there were attempts to minimize it. And so I used two words. I said, it's serious. And in data safety work, of which I've chaired over 24 data safety monitoring boards for randomized trials, big ones for the National Institutes of Health, Big Pharma,
yeah.
And I'm on DSMBs right now. I am a chair of DSMBs right now. I do this work. In safety research, we use the term tip of the iceberg, meaning this first signal, because it's just been detected now, could be the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
And fast forward, oh my Lord, now we have over 200 peer-reviewed papers in the preprint server system or in the National Library of Medicine PubMed on vaccine-induced myocarditis.
You know, and we're going to go through this, and I want to get into those in just a second, but just this idea, you said, you know, they were trying to minimize what they were seeing there. That should be so shocking, because the CDC, you know, the FDA, NIH, in the United States of America, you know, every country sort of has their regulatory agencies. But this idea, the scientific method, as I understand it, is you're supposed to challenge the hypothesis or challenge the product with all the skepticism you can muster up. The best scientists in the world are supposed to take every pot shot at it you can. If it stands up against that scrutiny, then you know it's safe. It's why we keep these things in a small controlled study, allow people to really, let's see the paper, let's see the peer review on it, let's talk about it. This is a product that's being released to everybody. As you said, a brand new technology, spelunking the immune system, messing with DNA, RNA, things we've never done before, is going out to a gigantic population, hundreds of millions of people in America, maybe a billion around the world, and you're telling me the regulatory agency that should be incredibly sensitive to any little movement is quelling what looks like could be a very large signal.
Because they're in the wrong position. This use is really important for the audience to understand. The named sponsors of the U.S. vaccine program are the FDA and the CDC. They should never be the sponsor of a program. The FDA's role is not to be a sponsor. It is actually supposed to be a safety watchdog agency.
Correct.
The CDC is supposed to be an investigational outbreak organization. The NIH is supposed to be a government research organization. We should have had a separate vaccine administration committee come together. It should have had an independent data safety monitoring board, type of stuff I do,
yep.
A clinical event committee to adjudicate these critical events, and we should have had a human ethics board assigned to the whole country. Actually, Office of Human Resource Protections in Washington would have been fine for that. That should have been the setup. So anytime there was a safety signal, the FDA would say, listen, we're the safety watchdogs. Show us these cases.
Right. We're skeptical. We're not going to buy this hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, listen, the FDA's pulled 100 drugs off the market. They have no problem pulling drugs off the market. The FDA usually has a conversation with the sponsor and says, listen, things aren't going good, so you can voluntarily recall it, or we're going to tell you to recall it.
Right.
And the FDA is good on it. The FDA is charged with protecting the safety of
But now they
Americans.
Are the sponsor. They're going to say to themselves, you got a choice here, you pull it, or you know.
They're not going to. They've been told. They've gotten their marching orders. Execute this program. It's
wow.
a needle in every arm. The president of the United States has barked a command saying, get vaccinated.
Right.
Do you think the FDA is going to say, wait a minute, we got a safety problem?
Let's talk about this safety problem now. We reported just a couple of weeks ago some really – you've been on before, so we've covered myocarditis. I think most of our audience recognizes you're a specialist here on this issue. You've been very outspoken at the risk. But there's a couple of studies that have just come out recently, and we covered them. I just want to sort of go over it to get your perspective. First of all, we have a study here. This is the JAMA Network. Myocarditis cases reported after mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccination in the U.S. from December 2020 to August 2021. As a passive system, VAERS data are subject to reporting. Now, that's VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. This is the CDC's capture system for vaccine injury. Data are subjected to reporting biases in that both underreporting and overreporting are possible given the high verification rate of reports of myocarditis to VAERS after mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccination. Underreporting is more likely. Therefore, the actual rates of myocarditis per million doses of vaccine are likely higher than estimated. And it has some numbers. So we look at background rate. In 12 to 15, we were supposed to be a background rate of 0.53% per million. This is like a half of one person per million might come away with myocarditis. But when vaccinated with a second dose, 70 cases per million. And then, you know, goes up 1.34. In the 16 to 17, we saw 105 cases. I mean, these are astronomical jumps. In the rate of myocarditis, what are we supposed to learn from
this? Well, let's just take this in context. This is from the Vaccine Event Reporting System, right?
Right.
VAERS. So that means that in a paper by Meisner and colleagues before COVID, in the pediatric literature, Meisner asked the question, who reports to VAERS? Where does the data come from?
Yeah.
Answer, 86% of the time, it's a doctor, it's a nurse, coroner, healthcare personnel, or the pharmaceutical company itself reports to VAERS.
Right.
14% of the time, it's the patient or the patient's family. So VAERS right now should already tell you it's a serious form of reporting.
Right.
It's not willy-nilly. Now, there is a self-reporting system that our CDC has for COVID. It's called VSafe, and you
right.
can do it on your phone. This isn't VSafe. This is VAERS.
Right.
Now, VAERS is multiple forms filled out online or in a PDF.
Right.
And I can tell you the average submission takes about half an hour. If falsified reports are done, punishable by imprisonment or federal fine.
Really?
So it is the most serious thing as a doctor that I do. They want my name all over this. Who are you? Where's your office?
Because
your
we are told
number?
That VAERS is just this system. Anyone can report to it. You can't trust it. It's not reviewed. It's not verified.
It's trustable with what's in there, and this type of research is done with those with a permanent VAERS number. So everything gets submitted to VAERS,
okay.
and it gets a temporary VAERS number. Then the CDC starts to look at it, and when it looks legit, they convert it over to a permanent VAERS number.
Okay.
So all the queries that we do in the open VAERS data system and the direct queries we do is on those with permanent VAERS numbers. Okay.
Okay.
So if it's 0.5 per million,
yep.
and they come up with a rate of 70 per million after the vaccine. The CDC originally had 63 per million.
Right.
Tracy Hogue from UC Davis, using VAERS and VSafe, she came up with a number of roughly 90 per million, and now we have the Scharf paper.
Well, let's get it. We have the
Scharf
paper. Let's
Scharf.
Pull that up. All right. Risk of myopericarditis following COVID-19 mRNA vaccination, a large integrated health system, a comparison of complete and timeliness of two methods, okay? And in this, conclusions, we identified additional valid cases of myopericarditis following an mRNA vaccination that would be missed by the BSD's search algorithm, which depends on select hospital discharge diagnosis codes. The true incidence of myopericarditis is markedly higher than the incidence reported to U.S. advisory committees. This matters, and here's the numbers, right? Here's where they show, and you can see that age group, you know, right here, the 537 cases per million in 18 to 24 years old. We were just talking about 70. Now we're talking about 534 cases per million.
Okay, so this is very important. So the age range, 18 to 24, 90% of these are boys or men.
Okay.
So interesting. That's actually consenting age. So the highest risk are people who give their own consent. This isn't a parental protection of child issue anymore,
right,
or assent or whatever, legally authorized representative. These are consenting adults, males age 18 to 24, rate 537 per million. And when we add in a paper that Rosa and myself published in Current Problems of Cardiology, we showed the age range extends all the way up to age 50 in VAERS. Now it's skewed. It peaks at around 18 to 24, but it goes all the way up to age 50. Now there's two reports that just hit the literature, and there they actually have two men in their 60s with pretty significant myocarditis. So it certainly can occur later. The point is, of using all these different capture methods, is use of ICD codes and automated codes versus self-report and then clinical ascertainment. For someone who takes a vaccine, let's say a young person,
right,
we would expect they go to a vaccine center. There's no ICD codes generated.
Right.
They should take the vaccine, go home, go to work, and they're fine. They should never generate any clinical ICD codes.
So describe what an ICD code is for your labor.
An ICD code is the International Classification of Diseases. When someone comes in to a ER,
yep,
or a hospital, there is coding that's applied.
Right.
And that coding generates bills for it generates the hospital bill, basically.
Okay.
And so
every single ailment you can possibly have has a code.
Right,
so
it's sensitive. So,
right.
So if there's chest pain, that's a code. If it's myocarditis, now that's a more specific code. And then an elevation in troponin in myocardial infarction, it goes on and on. So
all have their own codes.
Right, so there's ways to use codes to identify diseases. So in a situation where someone takes the vaccine and they're expected to generate no codes because they won't go into the ER, using the methods that Scharf used are legitimate because these people are going to a healthcare provider with a problem and the codes look like it's myocarditis.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, in the VAERS system, there's no ICD codes. There, largely the doctors, the nurses, the pharmaceutical companies, somebody thinks the vaccine caused it, and in fact, they actually say it's myocarditis.
Yep.
Okay. And the CDC is calling to verify it's myocarditis. So what we have in VAERS and VSAFE looks pretty solid.
Yeah.
What we have in papers that are clinical papers that have actually looked at vaccine myocarditis, where they actually have the patient's records, they have the EKG, the troponin, the echo or MRI, and the clinical course. That would be the shower paper, as an example, is a good one. Truong.
All these other places to collect the data that VAERS isn't looking at.
Yeah, where they actually have the clinical encounters.
Yeah.
What we've learned from the clinical papers, not from the ICD code papers and not from VAERS, is that in the clinical papers, A, it looks very serious. It looks like the symptoms are deceptive. So some of these younger people, maybe they just have a little fever. They haven't had much chest pain. They have anything else, and they come into to clinical recognition. And then, very importantly, the vast majority, far more than 95%, have major heart damage by MRI. That's the big shocker.
Yeah.
That's the big shocker. So the clinical papers are worrisome. That what they're finding, very high cardiac troponins, heart damage by MRI.
Yep.
And because of the enthusiasm for vaccines, which is universal among doctors, we really have to discount their conclusions.
You've been talking about codes, and I think it's important because there's a study that, you know, the pro-vaccine side of this, those that are really excited about it, are pointing to this study that basically says the infection itself, having natural COVID, is, you know, worse than the vaccine when it comes to myocarditis.
Before you show this, let's establish the context.
Okay.
Again, if you get COVID-19, the respiratory infection,
yes.
You go get it. You go to a community.
You get a natural infection.
Yeah, natural infection. You go to a community testing center. You get a swab. You're COVID positive. You're told to go home. You do that.
Yeah.
And you get through COVID. You will never generate anything of interest
okay.
in terms of ICD codes. You're at home.
Right.
You can't generate them. You,
right.
you only get generated when you go generate a hospital bill.
Okay.
Now the question is, what if you're sick enough to be in the hospital?
Right.
Now, in order to get hospitalized with COVID, now some of your listeners have been hospitalized with COVID, they know that
right.
you got to be really sick. When you're sick enough to be hospitalized with COVID or with pneumococcal pneumonia or gram-negative pneumonia or any other types of serious pneumonia, the blood test for heart injury called troponin is commonly positive. In fact, it's known in my field that it's roughly positive above the upper limit of detection about 50% of the time.
50% of the
because
time.
It's so stressful to be in the hospital. There is a release of troponin. It's typically not associated with EKG changes, with MRI,
okay.
or echocardiographic changes. There's an elevation in cardiac troponin. What happened is this elevation in troponin was tripping off ICD codes because they are generating lots of codes in the hospital.
Yep.
And the codes in the algorithm that positions codes for positive troponin was able to use ICD codes in these studies to declare myocarditis, even though it wasn't clinically validated myocarditis. It was
okay.
basically troponin elevation.
So they're looking at these codes and sort of triangulating and saying, this could have been myocarditis.
Right.
Got it.
Right.
Okay.
So it's an invalid use of ICD codes in hospitals, because if they would do the same exercise with non-COVID pneumonia, they'd come up with the same conclusion.
Okay.
So that's going to generate millions of billions of people who have these constellations of codes, and that's led to the incorrect conclusion that there's way more myocarditis with the respiratory infection than there is with the vaccine.
Let's show that study just so people know what we're talking about. This is the study that's being used to say risk of myocarditis from COVID-19 infection in people under age 20, population-based analysis. Here's basically what it said. For the 12 to 17-year-old male cohort, 0.09% patients developed myocarditis overall with an adjusted rate per million of 876 cases, obviously higher than the 537 we were just talking about with the vaccine. For the 12 and 15 and 16 to 19 male age groups, the adjusted rate per million were 601 and 561. So obviously these are huge numbers, and they're saying this is happening amongst the naturally infected. But what you're pointing out is you were looking at the worst case scenario of those that were naturally infected with COVID that ended up being hospitalized, and that these aren't even confirmed. It wasn't that a doctor says, you have myocarditis. They used all these different codes to say, well, if we group these codes together, there's a chance that it was myocarditis. Let's just consider it myocarditis. And they have this explosive, you know, percentage rate that if per million, if we had millions of these people, this is how many per million there would be. But it's a very specific, concentrated group of very sick people, sick enough to be in a hospital, and then a use of codes that isn't really an accurate use.
Right. The point is, it's contrived, and I think it's contrived to try to make the case that this is normal, that this is acceptable. And my point is, listen, if you get hospitalized with COVID-19, the respiratory illness, that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
If you take a vaccine, you should never be hospitalized due to the vaccine.
Right.
No.
No, so
no.
For a perfectly healthy
no,
person, it's supposed to make you healthier.
Yeah, it's supposed to make you healthier. No, the vaccine
right.
is not supposed to put you in the hospital.
Right. You sent over a study. They've done an autopsy now of two young men who died after myocarditis. And so let's just take a look at this, and maybe you can help me through it. Autopsy, histopathologic cardiac findings in two adolescents following the second COVID-19 vaccine dose. We suspect that the acute cardiac changes seen in these two boys are the result of epinephrine-mediated effects on cardiomyocytes. These occurrences generally have a favorable prognosis. However, some patients may die from the underlying non-cardiac cause of myocardial findings, such as with subarachnoid hemorrhage. On the epinephrine-mediated effects on cardiomyocytes, what does that mean?
There are some conditions in human medicine where there's a surge of adrenaline and noradrenaline in the body. There's a kind of three, in a sense, chemicals the body makes that really are save the body in a fight or flight situation,
okay.
and they're dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine. There are natural chemicals that
okay.
we make. In fact, when we give somebody epinephrine,
yeah.
we're actually giving the mimic of the human.
Okay.
Right. The human body does make some drugs in a sense. They make
yeah.
those are drugs. And there are conditions, so for instance, a subarachnoid hemorrhage, a massive hemorrhage in the brain can cause such an outpouring of these catecholamines where they're toxic to the heart, and the heart can actually have QT prolongation and have a cardiac arrest. There is a condition where there's incredible stress, emotional stress, and there's an outpouring of catecholamines, and the heart responds abnormally. It's called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy,
right,
and stress cardiomyopathy. It's also called the broken heart syndrome, where there can be a cardiac arrest or a picture that looks like a heart attack. In these cases, what happened is boys, they're teenage boys,
yep,
they took shot number one, they took shot number two, and on days 3 and 4, clockwork, exactly what Tracy Hogue showed in UC Davis, the boys are found dead at home. They're found dead. Parents are obviously devastated. The coroner gets involved, and they have University of Michigan pathologists get involved, University of Minnesota pathologists get involved, and they do a thorough autopsy. They don't find Takotsubo. They don't find subarachnoid hemorrhage. They find myocarditis in the heart, and they show inflammatory cells in the heart. Interestingly, in the case number two, that's in the figures, there's actually inflammation of what's called the cells around the capillaries called pericytes. So that matches exactly what Avolio and colleagues shown in the preclinical paper, that the spike protein in the human heart affects the pericytes, the support cells around capillaries and cardiomyocytes. Mm. So there's clearly inflammation, and there's this superimposed catecholamine effect, which I'm not surprised. When these boys at home who had cardiac arrests, and these are healthy boys, there must have been a massive surge of catecholamines. There must have been a struggle. Maybe they sought help. Maybe they were struggling to get on the phone or a cell phone. They knew something was going down, and then finally they just went down and they died. There was no one there. So the important point is there was no opportunity for CPR. There was no opportunity to call 911.
Right.
It was cardiac death. Now, we don't know if the boys were previously that day playing basketball. We know in the site of myocarditis that physical activity is out, and this triggering of cardiac death with exertion is well known in myocarditis. It's so well known that our guidelines say don't trigger it. But these autopsies are conclusive. They died of myocarditis. They died exactly when we thought it would after the vaccines. Now, it follows on a paper by Choi that showed that in a 22-year-old Korean man,
mm-hmm,
who died after Pfizer. Now, he had chest pain for 5 days before he went into the hospital, and he died within 7 hours in the hospital. And it follows on a paper by Verma from St. Louis that was in the New England Journal of Medicine last summer with a fatal case, and they showed the histopathology. And I was on national TV recently asked to comment on this. And I can tell you my point is, where are the FDA warnings now that upgrade myocarditis that it could be fatal? Shouldn't parents and young adults consenting for the vaccines know that they could get myocarditis? The FDA already says this with Pfizer and Moderna, that in fact the vaccines cause myocarditis. There's
right.
No controversy here. They're saying it caused they need to say that it can cause myocarditis and it can take your life.
This study was interesting, I mean, in reading it, because it basically said, though, this isn't like the myocarditis we usually see. This seems to be induced by cytokine storm, you know, or cytokines, and you know, do you know what it's referencing there?
It's each different myocarditis is going to have their own signature. The most lethal is called giant cell myocarditis. They didn't find giant cells there. You know, what's adenovirus or parvovirus is going to be a bit different. This is lipid nanoparticles delivering the genetics for the spike protein. The spike protein shown expressed in pericytes causing inflammation, which is exactly what was shown there.
Yeah.
And then it shows this superimposed catecholamine effect. It's worrisome for many reasons, because if the authors are right and there's a superimposed effect of catecholamines, boy, does this make this the setup for these sports cardiac arrests that we're seeing.
All those athletes we see, we're getting attacked for having a video that we keep putting out. There's over 100 athletes now plunging face first into the turf.
This is what the pathologists are basically saying.
Wow.
This looks unique, that this could be the setup for a stress induced with catecholamines triggering a cardiac arrest. That's what they're pointing out.
When we're seeing these numbers of 500, you know, cases per million, is your thought that we're not, I mean, do you think it's larger than that? Are there a lot of cases that are just going undetected, or do you feel like that's going to be pretty accurate?
Boy, it's hard to tell. The VAERS system, I think I quoted at the U.S. Senate, was over 20,000 cases that they know about, and there's an underreporting
right
factor. So underreporting in VAERS for mortality based on CMS data that came through the whistleblower lawsuit to the FDA came out at about 5 as an underreporting factor. For all-cause mortality extended out to 20 weeks, the paper by Pantazakos and Solomon from Columbia, that underreporting factor came out to 20. So let's, for easy math, say that we have an underreporting factor of 10 for myocarditis. Then if we have 20,000 cases in VAERS, that means the real number in the United States is 200,000 kids who have had myocarditis enough to become to clinical attention. We must be starting to see large hospitalization numbers. Now, University of Toronto recently had a paper come out and say, listen, we've got 100 cases. University of Utah at Salt Lake put together a case series, 140 cases. Can you imagine if we have, we have 5,600 hospitals in the United States, 2,200 acute care hospitals. Can you imagine if each hospital can generate 100 cases?
Wow.
This is all tractable. We may have that many cases of myocarditis. So we need a ton of research on vaccine-induced myocarditis. Who's at risk for it? Does previously having COVID set someone up? Is it actually the dose of the spike protein? What are the determinants? How to diagnose it? Obviously, we need treatment. We haven't talked about that, but I try to just empirically use combination of colchicine and prednisone, and then if there's any signs or symptoms of heart failure by clinical exam, by echocardiography, MRI, and there's three important biomarkers to measure. It's not only cardiac troponin, but BNP, ST2, and galactin 3. That gives us kind of this idea of, is the heart under strain?
Right.
And I've had some late cases of myocarditis where, in fact, wow, the markers really show it. And I have one right now who's about 9 months into it. His heart has finally recovered in terms of ejection fraction. But I really wonder, even though I got the heart pumping function back to normal, he doesn't feel normal. I really wonder long term, is this going to be okay? There's great uncertainty. The human heart is a precious asset. We would want no damage. We need this heart to carry us our entire lifetime. Right. And to put the kids behind with an unnecessary insult to the heart is unthinkable. That's the reason why I say one case is too many. And so what I've said is that we need, this is a crisis of compassion. We need people to recognize these are brand new vaccines.
Yeah.
They weren't safety tested. Now we're seeing in the peer-reviewed literature, we have 1,000 papers overall, about half in the preprint service system, half that are fully published, 200 on myocarditis. Is incontrovertible that vaccine injuries are happening.
Right.
They are described. Myocarditis is officially recognized. Vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpura is officially recognized. Partial venous thrombosis, a portal thrombosis with messenger RNA, officially recognized. Guillain-Barré syndrome, officially recognized. Bell's palsy, cervical myelitis. It goes on and on. These, as the medical literature evolves, this idea is going to have to get into the minds of doctors to be ready to receive these cases. They cannot deny these cases. Patients are furious.
Are you at all concerned? You're really out warning signals to saying, certainly when it comes to the youth, do not vaccinate the children now. Obviously, everything in medicine, it's a bet in some way. You're betting on what you're seeing as the outcome here. You're crunching the numbers. This is right in your wheelhouse. Is it accurate to say you're the most published heart doctor in the world? I've heard that statement made.
I am in this area of heart-kidney interaction. So to give you an idea, an average professor of medicine would have 25 peer-reviewed publications in the National Library of Medicine, PubMed. That would be pretty solid. That used to be a standard. I have 660 plus peer-reviewed publications in the National Library of Medicine. I'm the editor of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. For decades, I published a chapter in Braunwald's textbook Cardiology in Harvard, considered the Bible of cardiology.
Right.
And so, I've chaired data safety monitoring boards. I've presented before the FDA and the U.S. Congressional Oversight Panel. I have, given lectures all over the world, New York Academy of Sciences. I was the endowed lecturer at Harvard 2 years ago for both cardiology and nephrology division. And in COVID-19 now, I have over 50 peer-reviewed publications on COVID-19 or been the author block or contributor to including the two seminal papers on early treatment. I am telling you, Del, I am not shy about telling you. I am in a position of authority when I tell the world I am concerned about this and I have legitimate concerns, and they so far have not been handled.
As this seems to be a growing issue, are you, do you have a concern, because you're really putting your butt on the line here, that the powers that be, we're global interests, who knows, as you said, we don't know really what's behind all this, that they'll be somehow able to sort of cover up all of these children that are being injured and all the various things and just say it never happened? Do you have a concern with that, or do you just feel like it's just inevitable, it is going to be obvious to the world, and there's just no way they're going to be able to hide it?
It's going to be obvious. You know, Robert Malone said it really good on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. You and I both presented there, too. It was a terrific experience. But Malone said something that stuck in my mind. He said, the truth is like a lion.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Let it out. The lion can defend itself. And it's true. The truth can defend itself. This is so big. This problem is so big. I mean, think about it. We didn't start vaccinating the kids until midpoint of last year, just about.
Right.
200 peer-reviewed papers smoking in the medical literature within 6 months. This is going to be a torrent. There's going to be thousands of papers. Thousands. There will be thousands of papers. There's papers of all the different permutations. Myocarditis, conduction system destroyed, needs a pacemaker. When I was on Joe Rogan, I was describing myocarditis, and Joe goes, oh, we've already reviewed a case of myocarditis of a young girl who had it, and it took her all the way to the point of transplant, and then she died with an infection after the transplant. There's already Fabian Schrumpf, the Olympic marathoner from Switzerland, who told the Swiss news agencies, yeah, I took the vaccines, and I took the booster, now I've got myocarditis, and I can't run. It will come out. All the athletes who are having these sudden death episodes, it's been calculated what's the rate of sudden death before COVID and afterwards, and obviously there's been a big explosion. But sooner or later, people are going to put this together and figure out who took the vaccines and when. With myocarditis, it looks like it is temporally related. I think that's the agreement is, and I don't want to scare people out there. You know, if someone took a vaccine, let's say a young man who's 30 took the vaccine, they took it a year ago, are they going to explosively develop myocarditis 9 months from now? I doubt it.
Right.
Now, could they have had subclinical myocarditis and have a problem later on? You know, I do have people report this to me, say, listen, I took the vaccine in March, but I still don't feel right now. I have some effort intolerance. I can't work out the way I used to.
Mm-hmm.
What do I think of as a cardiologist? I think, oh, my gosh, did they take some heart damage? They're young and they're otherwise compensating. And I think there's going to be a lot of cardiac evaluations for either acute myocarditis, subclinical myocarditis, and then something happens, or actually missed myocarditis, and then they have a cardiomyopathy later on.
Do you recommend people that have been vaccinated going and getting that checked?
I think it has to be symptom-driven. I think people took the vaccine, and they're perfectly fine. I don't think we should conjure up. I mean, that's a lot of people. You know, in the United States,
there's 200 million people go pouring into the
hospital. Yeah, we have 200 million people, and we could raise a lot of it. And people in my family took the vaccines, and people in my social circles have taken the vaccines. The last thing we want to do is we don't want to – COVID-19 was enough of a fear storm in the United States. We don't want to conjure up more large numbers of fearful people, but at the same time, we want to protect people against what we think is going to be a scourge of vaccine-induced injury syndromes. These look legitimate. The pathophysiology is there. We know the spike protein is dangerous, and it makes sense for some people. Maybe it's the distribution of lipid nanoparticles. Maybe their import mechanisms are vigorous and they take up more genetic material. It explains why younger people may have more. That where the spike protein is expressed, how the body responds to it. Maybe they've been previously primed with COVID-19 respiratory illness, then they get the vaccines. Or maybe like the case I described, maybe she was primed with the vaccines and then she gets the respiratory illness. I have a feeling that repeated doses, respiratory illness and vaccines and boosters may play a role. That one I think is going to be tractable.
So we've covered myocarditis, I think, very thoroughly here. But a lot of myocarditis, people are going to live with it. It's going to be fine. It seems like the ultimate outcome that we have to be concerned about is death. We're seeing, you know, all-cause mortality on the climb all over for many different reasons, these heart issues. But, you know, do you believe these vaccines are causing death? Now, I say that the CDC says there's no evidence that the vaccines are causing death. What is your feeling on that?
Well, we have two cases right here that Gill and colleagues clearly say the vaccines cause death in these two young boys, and it's myocarditis. And Choi said that in myocarditis, and Verma said it. So there is a published literature that says that these cases they're describing. Now, the question is, are these large numbers of deaths are related to the vaccines? And we mentioned over 20,000 cases of myopericarditis in the open VAERS data overlay. And in the same overlay, over 20,000 deaths in the